Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world.
First, the U.S. and Russian governments have agreed on plans for an end to hostilities in Syria. The agreement could lead to an expansion of humanitarian aid to Syrians displaced by the fighting. George Groh has more.
The U.S. State Department said the truce would not include Islamic State militants and the Al-Nusra Front, a group linked to Al-Qaeda. More than 150 people were killed this weekend in bombings. Earlier, the Islamic State claimed responsibility for a series of bombings in Syria. The United States strongly condemned the bombings, while Russia said the attacks were aimed at harming peace efforts. In Damascus, more than 80 people were confirmed dead after bombings on Sunday. Explosions in homes killed at least 59 others. Russia's foreign ministry said in a statement, the attacks need an acceptable reaction from the international community. Russia and the United States have been working to persuade opposing sides in the Syrian conflict to accept a new ceasefire proposal. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Sunday, a provisional agreement had been reached with Russia and could begin within a few days. He spoke by telephone with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Neither man released details of the plan. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad said his government is ready for a ceasefire, but not if terrorists use it to strengthen their positions. He has often used the word terrorists when talking about any opposition fighters. The Syrian conflict began in March 2011. The main rebel coalition in Syria has said it is willing to accept a temporary truce, but only if Russia calls a halt to its airstrikes. The rebel coalition also wants the Syrian government to end its offensive near the country's border with Turkey. Russia has said it will not stop its airstrikes against what it calls terrorist targets in Syria, even if there is an international agreement on a temporary truce. The United States and others involved say most Russian bombs are directed at rebels fighting the Syrian government, not at Islamic State fighters. I'm George Groh.
The suspect in a mass shooting in the northern U.S. state of Michigan was charged Monday with multiple murders. Jason Dalton, 45, was arrested early Sunday morning. He was charged with shootings around Kalamazoo, Michigan, where 7 were killed and 1 was wounded. The shootings took place at 3 sites Saturday evening. A woman was wounded at an apartment complex. A father and son were killed while looking at vehicles at an automobile dealership. Minutes later, 4 were killed and 1 person was wounded outside a restaurant. The wounded victim, a 14-year-old girl, died early Monday morning, according to the Associated Press. Law enforcement authorities say the shootings were done on a random basis. Dalton, the suspect, was working for Uber, the ride-hailing service, when the shootings took place. Just after midnight on Sunday, police took Dalton into custody. Police also recovered a handgun. The suspect was described as being even-tempered when arrested. No motive has been given for the shootings. Dalton has no criminal record or history of mental disorders, according to authorities. The Michigan killings continue a violent trend in the United States this year. The website MassShootingTracker.org reported more than 40 mass shootings have occurred. Next, China's foreign minister will visit the United States to talk about East Asia territorial and defense issues. Mario Ritter has the story.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will host Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi for talks from Tuesday to Thursday. The visit comes at an intense time in relations between the two powers. The U.S. and China face the issues of militarization and free navigation in the South China Sea. They also face the issue of North Korea's nuclear weapons and missile programs. Last week, the U.S. said China had increased tensions by deploying missiles to a small island in the South China Sea. Vietnam and Taiwan also claim Woody Island in the Paracels Island group as their territory. During a news briefing on Monday, a Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman spoke to reporters. Hua Chunying was asked whether China's missiles in the South China Sea would be discussed during the meeting. She said, "The South China Sea is not and should not become an issue between China and the U.S." She said the U.S. should, in her words, stop hyping up the issue. Hua repeated the Chinese position that the island in question has been part of China since ancient times. Hua added that China's deploying necessary limited defensive facilities on its own territory is not substantively different from the United States defending Hawaii. U.S. ships have carried out patrols in the South China Sea. China says the patrols increase tension in the area. The U.S. says it is securing freedom of navigation in the important trade route. More than $5 trillion in oil and goods pass through the sea each year. On Monday, a top U.S. naval officer was reported as saying Australia and other countries also should carry out freedom of navigation naval operations. Such patrols would approach within 18 kilometers of the disputed islands. China continues to build up the disputed island and others in the Paracels. State-owned China Southern Power Grid Company says it will set up a power management system on Woody Island. Chinese officials say the electrical system will be connected to 16 other islands in the area. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua also was asked about a possible UN Security Council resolution on sanctions against North Korea. She said the U.S. and China are in close communication on the Korean Peninsula nuclear issue. She said China supports a resolution on North Korea. However, Hua repeated China's strong opposition to the possible deployment of the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, missile system in South Korea. The U.S. high technology system is designed to shoot down missiles. I'm Mario Ritter.
This is What's Trending Today. By the time you get to be 106, you have seen and done a lot. And Virginia McLaurin is almost 107. But last week, McLaurin did something for the first time. She went to the White House. There she met President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama. She said it was something she never thought she would be able to do. "I thought I would never get in the White House," McLaurin said in a video posted on the White House's Facebook page over the weekend. McLaurin is an African-American resident of Washington, D.C. She was born in 1909 in South Carolina. A video of her celebrating Black History Month with the Obamas last week got people giddy on social media. Black History Month is celebrated every February, and it recognizes the contributions African Americans make to the world. More than 25 million people have seen the video since it was released Sunday night. The video was shared nearly 500,000 times on Facebook. McLaurin and the Obamas are two of Monday's top trending subjects on Twitter. The video shows McLaurin coming to meet President Obama and Michelle Obama. While posing for a picture after they are introduced, McLaurin says, "I am so happy. A Black president. Yay! A Black wife. And I'm here to celebrate Black history." People wrote messages of support, calling the video fantastically uplifting, and saying watching the video will make your day. One man from Brazil wrote, "She lived to see two world wars, the height of racial segregation, and finally an elected Black president." The Washington Post reports that McLaurin submitted a petition to the White House in 2014 asking to meet with Obama. She wrote about all the things she remembered from her life, like living without electricity, and the first Ford car she saw coming off the assembly line. "I didn't think I would live to see a colored president," she wrote. "I know you are a busy man, but I wish I could meet you." And when McLaurin finally met the Obamas, she danced with joy. "So what's the secret to still dancing at 106?" President Obama asked. McLaurin did not answer. She was so excited, she just kept on dancing. And that's what's trending today. I'm Ana Mateo.
The two leading political parties in the United States disagree on how and when the next Supreme Court justice should be named. But what are the rules and politics that govern the process in a presidential election year? Ann Ball and Mario Ritter are here to answer that question.
The death of a member of the United States' highest court has politicians arguing over who will take his place and when. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia died February 13th at age 79. He served on the court for nearly 30 years. He was one of its most conservative members. Scalia was nominated in 1986 during the presidency of Ronald Reagan. The Supreme Court is now split between four justices who often take liberal positions on legal issues and four others who are said to be conservative. Scalia's replacement could shape the High Court's decisions for years to come. Discussion about a new justice is heated, with the court considering cases on issues such as immigration and affirmative action. Liberals want President Barack Obama to name another justice before he leaves office. Conservatives do not. They hope a Republican is elected president in November. They believe that person would then appoint a conservative justice. Experts say Obama is considering at least five scholars from diverse backgrounds as a possible replacement for Scalia.
So, who has the power to name the next Supreme Court justice? The president or the people? Power to nominate the justices is vested in the President of the United States, and appointments are made with the advice and consent, or approval, of the Senate, according to SupremeCourt.gov. Those powers are guaranteed under the U.S. Constitution. Once confirmed, a justice can serve on the Supreme Court for the rest of his or her life. David Savage has reported on the court for 30 years for the Los Angeles Times and written a book about it. He says it is possible, but unlikely, that a new justice will be seated on the court before the next president takes office. The U.S. Supreme Court was created in 1789. Since then, 40 presidents have made 160 nominations to the court. The Senate confirmed 124 of those nominees. Seven others refused to serve. Worldwide, the Supreme Court serves as a model for the fair and democratic treatment of legal disputes. It is one of the three parts of the U.S. government: Congress, the judiciary, and the president.
Savage explains why some Americans think the Supreme Court has more power than the president.
Because it decides major constitutional issues that, once decided, have a huge impact across the country and basically can't be changed by the president.
The court, he says, decides big issues that affect many people in important ways.
You know, matters like abortion, the death penalty, affirmative action, gay rights, gun rights. When the court decides a constitutional issue and says there is a right to have a gun, and there is a right for same-sex marriages, that's a big change in the law. It affects a lot of people, and it goes well beyond, you know, one president's term.
If the president or American citizens do not like a Supreme Court ruling, it is very hard to change. There are several ways to do it, but they are difficult and require time. One way, says Savage, would be to pass a constitutional amendment, but that would need two-thirds of Congress and three-fourths of the state's approval. This is pretty unlikely to happen, he says, and it is almost impossible in today's politically divided country.
Another way to overturn a ruling would be if new justices were appointed to the Supreme Court. Then, a similar case could move through lower courts and be heard by the Supreme Court, where the new justices could overturn the earlier ruling. From time to time, the Supreme Court does overturn some of its earlier rulings. One such example came in 1954 in a case called Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. This ruling declared racial segregation unconstitutional. Brown overturned Plessy v. Ferguson, which in 1896 supported segregation or inequality among races. Over time, the court has ruled on equality for blacks, women, and gays, legalized operations for ending pregnancies, and approved use of the death sentence as a form of criminal punishment. It has supported the right to carry a gun and the right for people of the same sex to marry. Savage explains the court's decisions follow changes in American thinking and beliefs over time.
Well, I think it reflects American society in the sense that the big changes on the court really tend to flow out of big changes around the country and thinking.
Here are some other important cases the court has decided. Gideon versus Wainwright, 1963. States must provide defense lawyers to criminal defendants charged with serious crimes when the defendant does not have enough money for a lawyer. The Supreme Court ruled that the defense attorney must be paid for by the public.
Miranda v. Arizona, 1966. The court ruled that police must inform a suspect that they have the right to remain silent during questioning. Suspects must voluntarily give up those rights before police can use their statements in court against them.
Roe v. Wade, 1973. The court recognized that a woman's choice to end her pregnancy is protected by her right to privacy. The legalization of abortion continues to be debated in the U.S. today.
United States v. Nixon, 1974. This case showed that the president is not above the law, says Savage. President Richard Nixon had refused to give investigators tape recordings of him discussing the Watergate scandal with his aides. The Supreme Court ruled he must surrender those tapes. He did so and resigned as president 16 days later.
Citizens United versus FEC, 2010. The court ruled that the First Amendment allows individuals, corporations, and organizations unlimited spending on political elections. Since then, individuals or organizations have spent large amounts of money on candidates and causes of their choice. I'm Ann Ball.
And I'm Mario Ritter.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Helicopter parenting describes a style of raising children where parents are overprotective and do too much. The term was used for the first time in the late 60s. It describes parents who hover over their kids at home and at the playground, like a helicopter. Today, modern technology allows these helicopter parents to hover from even far away. They can give their children directions at any moment from anywhere. Author Julie Lithcott-Hames wrote a book titled How to Raise an Adult: Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kids for Success. In her book, she gives readers a closer look at this parenting style. She also explains why parents should stop it. Julie Lithcott-Hames says she experienced the effects of helicopter parenting firsthand when she worked as dean of first-year students at Stanford University. The incoming students, or freshmen, she says, were very smart and accomplished on paper, but many were unable to take care of themselves.
They were turning to parents constantly for guidance, for problem solving, to help them make a choice about something.
Oftentimes, Lithcott-Hames had to remind those parents that their kids were old enough to take care of themselves. However, one evening, she discovered that she too might be a helicopter mom.
I came home one day, my own kids were 8 and 10 at the time, and I leaned over at dinner, began cutting my 10-year-old son's meat. And I realized, oh my goodness, I'm overhelping my 10-year-old. He should be able to cut his own meat. It's my job to teach him. I haven't done that. I'm on track to being one of those parents. And that's when I began to develop real empathy for parents and realize we're overhelping with the best of intentions.
Overparenting, she says, comes in three types. The overprotective parent.
Overprotective, parent who thinks the world is scary and unsafe and unpredictable, and therefore I must protect and prevent.
The over-directive parent.
Second type is the over-directive type. This is a parent who says, I know best what leads to success, and you will do as I say. You will study these topics. You will do these activities. You will be, you know, highly achieving at all of it.
Finally, there is the concierge parent. The concierge at a hotel is the person who takes care of all your needs and makes your stay as perfect as can be.
The third type is the concierge, the parent who just wants to make life smoother. From waking their kid up, to keeping track of their deadlines, to making sure they haven't forgotten anything, to having those tough conversations with a teacher, to outright helping with the homework, maybe doing the homework for the kid.
Lithcott-Hames warns that this kind of parenting has many short-term wins, but long-term costs that harm the child. She uses an area common to most children, a playground. Lithcott-Hames suggests letting your child get a little hurt.
If you're at the playground next to them, if they fall or slip, you're right there to catch them, and they do not suffer, you know, the bruised knee or whatever it might be. If you're helping with your kid's homework, they're going to get a better grade. Those are short-term wins. The long-term cost is if your kid doesn't learn how to manage their own body on a playground, which is a lesson only learned by falling a few times, they don't learn the long-term lesson.
If you do your child's homework, it will be perfect. That is what she calls the short-term win. The long-term cost is that your child may not feel capable, and they may not become a persistent learner, meaning they will give up easily when faced with a difficult problem to solve.
And if you're always helping with their homework, what you're effectively telling them is, hey, kid, you're not capable of being a fourth grader. Don't worry, I'm going to help with your homework. They begin to feel less capable. They begin to feel very reliant upon parents to correct and perfect their academic work. It's not preparing them to be the persistent learners who will be successful in life.
So what can parents do if they want to break the overparenting helicopter cycle? Lithcott-Hames offers four ways to stop hovering over your children.
We have to stop saying we when we mean our son or our daughter. All too often, a parent will say, we're on the travel soccer team. Well, no, your son is or your daughter is. The next thing is we have to stop arguing with all of the adults in our kids' lives. We need to teach our kids to advocate for themselves. The third thing is we must stop doing our kids' homework. The fourth thing is we've got to build skills. Teach them to cross the street. Teach them to make a meal. Teach them to remember to put their own items in their backpack, which becomes a briefcase one day.
When kids have all the skills to take care of themselves, Lithcott-Hames says they will be prepared for adulthood. I'm Anna Mateo.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.